I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
I'm going to give the audience what I think they want.
They want chase scenes and car crashes.
They want the cops to bend the rules to get the job done. They want the boy to get the girl. They want the good guy to win. They want the bad guy to die, hopefully in the biggest explosion the budget will allow. But most importantly, Senator, they want to walk into a theater and for 90 minutes forget the fucking mess that you have left of this nation.
Go get your bubblegum.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Hello and welcome back to All Out of Bubblegum, the podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about John Milius's final film, Rough Riders. Today I have with me Marty and Brandon once again.
Hello.
Hello.
How are we doing, guys?
I'm doing great. I love this movie, yep. So I'm pretty hyped for it.
How does this fare in comparison to Gettysburg, which I think is kind of similar in tone, too?
Yeah, they're both made for, like, television, although Gettysburg got a theatrical release. Rough Riders is, of course, a made-for-TV movie that got a television release. They're pretty similar. They're both kind of these reverent historical epics that go on for hours and hours that have Tom Berenger in them. And Buck Taylor, I think, too. But they're both really good, but I think Rough Riders is better. That's just my opinion.
Another movie with Juliette Lewis's dad.
Yes, Jeffrey Lewis. Yes. He's in there as Eli, the cook that just wants to go to war when he sees his family every day.
What he really wants, though, is a hooker that makes him think that he's in love with her.
Spoiler alert, he gets it.
Yeah. That was one of my favorite denouments or whatever that I've ever seen. Little epilogue.
Mm-hmm.
It's just him surrounded by hookers, making him feel special.
Like, the biggest steak you've ever seen.
Yeah.
In front of him.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's a fantastic ending.
Yeah, it's great.
You don't think he's gonna fulfill the promise, but John Milius is like, no, I'm doing it, and it's for Jeffrey. He's getting it.
I mean, this is, I believe, the third John Milius film that Jeffrey Lewis has worked on. He was in Dillinger, he was in The Wind and the Lion, and now he's in Rough Riders. He's in the three best John Milius movies.
I think that The Wind and the Lion would be a great double feature with this.
Yeah, I think I suggested that originally, but we just decided to go with Rough Riders because it's so long.
Yeah, I think that's fair. This was a long one. Although Wind and the Lion also feels long, and it's very weird.
Oh, yeah.
You got the Scottish Muslim overlord or whatever.
Yeah.
You're like, okay.
Yeah. Shank on your place, Mustafa.
Yeah.
Something. Yeah.
El Razuli.
Yep. It's but I love that movie too, so whatever.
Yeah.
I totally get why you like this. There's a vibe, but man, is it just like super pro-war. Like, it really romances the grossness of war, which is really funny to me.
Yeah, it's all the wrong things. It's militaristic, it's jingoistic, it's nationalistic, it's imperialistic, it's it's all the bad things. But I still love it anyway, because it's just pure auteur filmmaking from John Milius on full blast.
Oh, yeah. Well, I thought for a little bit, I was like, I don't know how to feel about this movie until that ridiculously subversive shot where the American flag is barely hiding the corporate interest that sent them to war there.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Amazing shot.
The word empire on a, like, a big water tower thing.
Yeah, it's advertising the sugar company that basically got them into the war. It's so, I was like, wow, okay, Milius, that's not even subversive at this point, because it's almost dominating the frame, and he holds it for about 10 seconds.
Yeah, it's not subtle at all.
I also was like, the action's okay. There's a weird amount of people getting shot out of trees. and then the end is amazing. That the Kettle Hill and San Juan Hill fights are so cool, even though they're almost all wrong. But
it's
fantastic.
It's so thrilling, but it raises the moral question. Is it okay for war movie scenes to be thrilling? Shouldn't they be terrifying and horrific? Well, not in John Milius's mind, they're not.
No, this is like the glory of battle.
Yeah, this is like a Sabaton song in like movie form. It's great.
Also, just glazing Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes.
Man, do they love Teddy Roosevelt. Which is also weird, because the movie does something that I don't think I've ever seen Teddy Roosevelt be seen as in a movie. It allows him to be kind of a dork.
Yeah, he's a buffoon at times. He's not really self-aware. Yeah. He's just kind of like, my mom, she made grits, and we were nice, we made cheese grits. And, like, everybody else is, like, kind of, like, covering their mouth, trying to avoid laughing at him, and It's just a funny moment.
We sense him. He's like, my tailor, make this suit. Look at this. How doesn't it look great? And I'm just like, what the fuck is it? Like, he plays such a doof.
Yes.
Which is great because the scene that he has with Ileana Douglas,
mm-hmm.
where he's just like, okay, cool. I'm glad you're here. Let's go fuck.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
Yeah, weirdly good time with this. At first, I was like, because I think the very first couple scenes in the movie, because it's bouncing all over the place, like geographically as well,
mm-hmm.
I thought, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to handle this, because I was like, oh, it seems kind of bad. And then I think within like 5 minutes of thinking that, I started like kind of falling under the film's spell. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is crazy. I watched this in a full screen standard definition. I don't think this is on Blu-ray, but
I don't think so. It's not yet.
I mean, it's obviously made for TV kind of thing, even though it's it gets pretty violent, especially towards the end.
There's a lot of blood squibs. They're not graphic blood squibs, but they're definitely there.
Well, there's a couple headshots that were surprisingly violent.
Yeah, I remember like the one where one of the Buffalo soldiers is like peering out of a trench, then all of a sudden like a bullet just like hits the sand right in front of his face, and you're just kind of like, whoa.
Yeah. Well, actually, funny you bring up that shot, because that's one of the shots that I thought, I was like, oh, there's some interesting editing going on here, because they take that shot and they split it in half.
Ooh.
But they use an earlier shot.
Mm-hmm.
But the frame before that moment ends, you see the explosion begin.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was really funny.
I've seen this movie like 1,000 times, and I still haven't noticed that.
I noticed a lot of weird editing in this, but it's one of those, like, this is clearly, like, they're pressed for time, and they really banged this out.
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently it also uses a lot of mirror shots.
Well, and crop shots. They'll use the same shot again, but it's, like, uncropped now, so it looks like a whole different shot.
Yeah, it does, especially during the final battle scene. You can kind of see, like, machine guns with, like, the belt, machine gun bullet belt on the wrong side of the machine gun or whatever, supposedly, but I'm not really an expert that.
Well, I wouldn't have noticed if they hadn't made a point later on to be like, no, it's fed from this side.
It's fed from the right.
It wasn't earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't earlier. Also, that seems a little brutal, because at the end of it, they're like, kill that German.
Yeah, it's so bloodthirsty. Like, the whole movie is just so bloodthirsty. It's like killing people who are trying to surrender and celebrating it. And there were no German soldiers there in real life. There are no German advisors at the Battle of the San Juan Heights or anywhere in the Spanish-American War in real life. But John Milius can't resist just like throwing in Germans, just like he did in The Wind and the Lion. Got to have those Imperial Germans for the Americans to fight.
Yeah, because as we saw, the Germans at this time were in Africa. We saw that in later mission.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, flooding, Namibia.
Flooding the African subcontinent. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the main thing I would say that the movie gets wrong, but it was only slightly so, is that this was kind of the pre-World War I American conflict that changed the face of warfare, and you start seeing it. They used machine guns.
Yes.
And that changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's why they won. There was a guy that's not in the movie who was Lieutenant John Henry Parker.
Oh, I think he's in the movie for like 2 seconds. They say like, Lieutenant Parker, aim at those like trenches with your Gatling guns or something like that. But he's not like a star or anything like that.
Yeah, and that's the guy. He's the guy that really changed warfare.
Yeah.
He figured out how to use machine guns to lay down heavy fire, and he understood all the suppression, and he grouped the machine guns, and he fired something like 18,000 rounds on San Juan Hill, and it just, like, decimated them.
Oh, wow.
And then there was a point later on where they tried a counterattack, and it was like 600 guys charged them, and I think like 40 people survived, and that's... I mean, that just that moment was like, nope, this kind of thing where they rush forward is never going to happen again in that way.
Yeah, it's very clear in the film with all the machine gun usage and the long-range artillery, too. The rapid-fire breech-loading artillery gets used somewhat.
Yeah, that was cool.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they kind of get it, but they also don't. The movie's more not a... It's really trying to be a human story, not a technology story.
Yeah.
Even though that's kind of what it was in real life. But it's like they are missing those... that focus a little bit if he wanted to be historically accurate, but this is really a movie about the Gloria War, so they're not going to do that.
Yeah, but it's interesting because this film is actually kind of like a coming-of-age story, and not for, like, individuals, but for the entire nation of the United States, because the Spanish-American mm-hmm. War back in 1898 was kind of the event that turned the United States into a great power. So you're watching this movie, you're kind of like, oh, this is the United States exiting its awkward teen years and kind of entering adulthood. That's what I get from it, at least.
Well, the U.S. had not flexed its muscle yet. This is the first time they really did it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll do it at one point where they sail the fleet around the world.
Yeah, I think that started in 1907, yeah.
Yeah, and that was kind of a thing that we also got a fucking navy, too.
Yeah.
And now it's like, you know, we just dominate everything over here and scare the world, and we're like, you're our friend, right? That's what the U.S. does. But yeah, it's interesting to see the movie like capture this time in world history where, I mean, the Spanish was still a huge world power at this point.
They're in decline, but yeah, they still had like the Philippines and Guam and Puerto Rico and Cuba.
Not after this.
Yeah, the United States got them, yeah.
That must have been fucking crazy for the Spanish. Like, just imagine being in there like, oh yeah, well, we've been an empire for, you know, 600 years, and then suddenly it was like, oh, and this, like, new country just took, like, a quarter of our territory.
Yeah, there's...
what was it, 60 days, something like that?
It was short, but I think there's a phrase for, like, this Spanish generation. Like, I don't know what it's called, but there's, like, a phrase for the Spanish generation, how depressed they were that they lost their empire against the United States. I can't remember what it's called, like, but it is, there's a phrase for it.
Okay, that's kind of cool to know, actually.
Yeah, but before we go any further, maybe we should go over the plot of the movie a little bit. It's about the Spanish-American War, of course, in 1898. Which was like, for a long time, Spain had owned Cuba and the Cubans were rebelling for independence, and the United States sympathized with the Cuban rebels. And this was somewhat kind of like instigated by the Yellow Press at the time, as it was called, who like wrote all these newspaper stories that sometimes made up or exaggerated atrocities, which were very real. I mean, like thousands of Cubans did die, but it was sometimes exaggerated by the media. And American people were outraged. They're like, we need to free Cuba. Then when the Americans sent a battleship, the USS Maine, to just kind of monitor the situation, it mysteriously exploded. We now know it was probably an accident, something with the coal bunker. But back at the day, people were like, oh, this is Spanish sabotage. It's all their fault. We need to go to war. So the United States went to war with Spain. A lot of it was fought in Cuba, the Spanish colony. And this is what this movie is about.
It's a pretty good synopsis.
Yeah.
This Yellow Press that you mentioned, was William Randolph Hearst part of it?
Yes, he was kind of the ringleader of it. And he's in this movie, played by George Hamilton.
Yes.
And I believe...
His father is who Citizen Kane is based off of, I believe.
I think Citizen Kane is based off Hearst proper, isn't it?
I think so, too, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah, because, like, in Citizen Kane, doesn't he, like, start a war with Spain, basically, try to sell newspapers? It's been a while since I've seen it, yeah.
So that's referring to this...
Yeah.
Event.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. This is kind of like the big turning point in American history, and it's got a lot of important figures in it, like President William McKinley, played by Brian Keith, Secretary of State John Hay by Arlie Ermey, who does not scream at all in this movie, even though he's Ermey. And even though he was not Secretary of State yet at the time of the Spanish-American War, that was after the war that he became Secretary of State, but whatever.
Well, the movie plays pretty loose with history.
Yes. Not as loose as some films, but yeah.
No.
And Nick Chundlin plays...
Well, I think it mostly plays loose with the characters, what they were up to at the time and when they died. I think all the people are real people, but maybe they weren't involved in the events portrayed.
Well, in different aspects they were, and in different ways. Well, first off, almost none of the characters look anything like the people they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go on like Wikipedia and start clicking those blue links and looking at the people, you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
So way off. But they still managed to get a lot of like the main people and kind of charmingly cast a lot of them in ways that aren't maybe true to life, but are true to like the story he's trying to tell. And it kind of works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that, but... Brian Keith, you brought him up already, mm-hmm. playing President McKinley. Very funny. He played Roosevelt in The Wind and the Lion.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. I think the closest anybody comes to like really mirroring their real life counterpart is probably actually they got Marshall Teague playing Pershing.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, he looks kind of like him, and he's fantastic in the role.
Yeah, Pershing would later famously go on to command American troops in World War I, being the overall U.S. military commander in that war. But he's great in this, too. He plays the leader of the Buffalo Soldiers, the African-American soldiers who are still segregated into separate units. And he's really good in this movie. He's kind of like the by-the-books officer who still gets angry in the middle of combat. And he's good.
Yeah, his horse gets killed.
Mm-hmm.
But they also do a fun thing, which I thought was BS at first, but then I looked into it, and supposedly, according to him, this really happened, which was when they started going up the hill, they all like came together, and it didn't matter which unit they were in. They were all fighting side by side. You know, you had somebody like Mr. Big from Sex and the City. Mm-hmm. He's plays this polo player who's now in the war because he wants to prove to himself that he's manly. And then you have the Buffalo Soldiers, you know, right there with him. And somebody that's, what's the guy that's in the bookends?
Oh, Brian Johnson's character. Yeah, Henry Nash.
Yeah, it's who's apparently like a coach robber or something. You're like, well, okay. And, but, you know, that's the point of the movie is like, oh, no, this is like all these different types came together and they fought for the same goal. And you have everyone's weirdly respectful of Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Even though he's a doof.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, that guy's kind of cool. He remembered my name.
Yeah. There is a scene where Henry Nash is like, he remembered my name.
Yeah. But apparently that really happened, according to Pershing, it really happened where they all just kind of came together, as he said, shoulder to shoulder, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's cool.
Probably also down to the chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the battle scenes in this. To me, this is what, like, the more thrilling side of battle scenes in movies should be like. Obviously, Saving Private Ryan nails the more, like, realistic, gritty, gory side of, you know, realistic battle scenes. But to me, if, like, you're trying to make a battle scene that's kind of fun, even if that is kind of distasteful, I think Rough Riders is probably, like, the gold standard.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty well up there. The only thing it's missing is, like, a really heartfelt Richard Jordan-esque performance, you know, where you just got somebody that just like steals the movie away and you're like, wow, that was great. The closest you get is actually Tom Berenger apologizing for calling them cowards.
Yeah.
At one point.
You don't think Gary Busey steals a show?
He's a lot of fun. He does exactly what you want Gary Busey to do.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God, this guy's a nutter. And
constantly referring to the Spaniards as Yankees.
Which is rooted in truth. I mean, he did call them on at least one occasion. Maybe not constantly, but at least on one occasion, he did say, we've got the Yankees on the run in real life. But they took that and ran with it and just made it the most absurd thing you'd possibly imagine.
How about Bucky O'Neill?
Oh.
Sam Elliott's character?
Yes.
That's my favorite thing is, you know, he's going, I'm too old for this shit. Or something, I'm getting too old for this shit. And then I was like, his character was like 38.
Yeah. It's my favorite Sam Elliott role. I think he's perfect for this.
Yeah.
That's because you haven't seen The Big Lebowski yet.
Ugh. I'll watch it today, I promise.
Okay. He's barely in that movie. You're just like, yeah, you're going to love him in this. He's like, yeah. 30 seconds of screen time is going to kick your ass. But yeah, I love seeing character actors, and this movie's just so chock full of them that I'm like, yeah, this is fun.
It's definitely a Milius movie.
Yeah.
Because John Milius, he always has like all these character actors that are having so much fun because he makes the role so pulpy and heightened and macho and heroic. The actors are probably just digging it so much, you know? It's like, they're having so much fun in, like, this movie, it looks like.
This was something of a passion project for Berenger, I believe.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think he had so much fun making Gettysburg that he just really wanted to do another historical epic type thing and play Teddy Roosevelt, especially.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
It explains why he's listed as producer, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting because Theodore Roosevelt in real life, after the Battle of the San Juan Heights, he was hyped up. He was like, oh, I killed so many people. This is so much fun. I love killing people. And he's basically a psychopath in real life. But in this movie, Theodore Roosevelt is just kind of like very kind of like solemn and just kind of like, oh, you're not cowards. I misjudged you. You're all heroes. And he cries, maybe not cries, but just kind of sits, you know, contemplatively near the American flag. But in real life, he was just like hopped up and just like, yeah, I love killing people, you know?
Yeah, the dude was a maniac.
Yes.
But this movie tries its best to kind of glamorize him, which I kind of appreciate because, you know, historically speaking, he's probably one of my favorite presidents, so.
Yeah.
It's hard to, I think he's a hoot.
Yeah,
the guy got shot. He did the Trump thing before Trump. Mm-hmm. Got shot at doing a speech. And then continued his speech.
Yeah, with a bull.
He just was like, it takes more than a bullet to take down a bull moose. Anyways, let me bore you with an hour of speech.
Yeah, he's quite a character. The film does downplay his racism a little bit, but that's okay. Yeah. I mean, obviously racism is bad, but I don't know if this was appropriate time to just bog down the audience talking about how racist Theodore Roosevelt was.
Especially since I brought up with the Pershing stuff, it's kind of trying to show America coming together for something.
Yeah.
Which it does weirdly in this that early moments where they show the USS Maine explode,
mm-hmm.
which was kind of the galvanizing incident for the Spanish-American War. But they just kind of show it like a little montage in the beginning of the movie using like archive footage and stuff.
I think it's really effective.
But that honestly should have been like a big moment. But they're like, yep, that thing happened. Now we're all here.
Well, the budget didn't allow for it. I think the budget is used very well in this movie. But there are a couple moments where you kind of like say, okay, maybe they didn't have unlimited resources filming this. There are like a couple moments during like the Battle of the San Juan Heights when there's like not that many soldiers on the battlefield. Or there's the moment when they land in Cuba where you don't see like a single boat. And you're just kind of like, okay, I guess they are in Cuba now. But for the most part, you know, I think the budget was used wisely.
Yeah, I remember there was a part where I could tell that they'd stuck palm leaves into the ground
mm-hmm.
to make it look like they were in Cuba. And then there was some parrots.
Yeah.
See, we're not in Texas anymore. But yeah, it's making the most of it. I think it had about the same budget as Gettysburg.
I think it had like $19 million.
Yeah,
which isn't exactly small, but
not in the 90s.
A lot.
Yeah, and I think Gettysburg was about the same. I think it was like $20 million. So
yeah, they're both Ted Turner passion projects, aren't they?
I think he was a Civil War nut. So yeah. He liked that era.
Yeah.
Because he was there.
Yeah, he's old enough to be there. And one of my favorite aspects of the film, I love the action, I love the characters, but I love the musical score. It's done primarily by Peter Bernstein, who is the son of Elmer Bernstein. And Elmer Bernstein helps him out a little bit with some of the music. And even though it kind of apes some previous musical scores a little bit, like you can hear a little bit of Quigley Down Under and Lonesome Dove, a little bit of those musical scores in here, which were both done by Basil Poltorius, who is a frequent John Milius collaborator. I think it's still a great musical score. I mean, it's so exciting and it carries the action so well. I think it's great.
I'm more in the it's fine camp as far as the musical score goes.
Okay.
I was like, it reminded me of the music from Gettysburg, honestly.
Yeah, both kind of maybe a little overbearing at times, but I enjoyed it. I like that kind of loud and proud musical score.
Yeah, it was, to me, it's more like the, it's like being sentimental and patriotic at the same time.
Yeah, there is that.
Which fits the movie.
Yeah, but this is largely a movie about like male bonding. And so all these different guys from different walks of life come together and become best buds.
Yeah, it's very macho. There's a lot of like caressing of dying and wounded people, you know, that may be seen as somewhat homoerotic to some audiences. But I don't know.
Maybe... Yes, the news guy and the writer.
Yeah.
Crane and I can't remember the other.
Edward Marshall, name. Played by William Catt.
Yeah, that whole thing. They really push it for me. that was where I was like, you guys don't need to make this whole thing a whole damn scene. But they did. He's just describing the war to him.
Yeah.
Which is also like probably for our benefit because that also fills in some of those budget gaps.
Oh.
Because he's just going, the men are cresting the hill. I can see the silhouettes against the sky and saying all this stuff. And I'm like, well, you know, show don't tell, John.
There's a few other good supporting performances in here, like Anthony Quinn's son is in this movie, Francisco Quinn. He plays Rafael Castillo, who's like this Mexican-American volunteer, and he does pretty well. I think he gets promoted to sergeant, and he does well.
I thought he looked a lot like Anthony Quinn, so that actually explains a lot.
Yeah,
I actually had the exact same thing going on, so that explains it. I was like, there's this like Mexican guy in the movie with the mm-hmm. little handlebar mustache thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
Little chopper stash, and I was like, he looks so familiar, but I have no idea who he is. Yeah.
And there's Nick Chunland as Frederick Remington, the famous American painter. And this film does look like a Frederick Remington painting come to life at times, especially kind of like the old Western scenes, you know, towards the beginning of the movie, like when they're riding on horses and stuff like that. And you're just kind of like, yeah, this is Remington. This feels like a Remington painting come to life.
Well, it's probably a frame of reference for a lot of people when it comes to this war.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for me it is. That's like that's how I know this is the old drawings and everything that you know, in school that we would see.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's only smart on the filmmaker's part to borrow from his paintings.
Yeah.
Because that's the image that most people have of the war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely takes a print the legend approach to the Spanish-American War for the most part.
100%.
Yeah, okay, 100%, yeah.
But that's sort of what's fun about it. I mean, it does the same thing with Wind of the Lion, honestly, where you're like, okay, he glamorized these guys in ways which may or may not be responsible. I don't know. You know, I guess what I'm going to say is that I'm just happy that somebody's covering this war.
Mm-hmm.
It's not covered enough. Just like the Mexican-American War is never covered. Nobody ever talks about it.
Yes. Of course, Mexican-American War is kind of like, that's the war we don't talk about. That's the one that's just like a Putin-esque land grab against Mexico. We don't really talk about the Mexican-American War.
Yeah. So a good deal of the generals in the Civil War were veterans of the Mexican-American War.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yes.
That's why anybody says they're any good is actually because they were fully experienced.
You know what? I think we had a similar conversation on our Gettysburg episode.
Yeah, there's too many wars to list.
Yeah. What? Americans in war? That never happens.
Never.
But I actually think that the first hour and a half of this movie isn't all that militaristic and pro-war. I actually think it does a good job of showing that a lot of it is just political. The sugar industry is behind it. And it isn't until the actual fighting starts that the movie becomes more pro-army, pro-soldier.
Okay.
Yeah, John Milius, he's interesting. He likes to have it both ways. It's kind of like the Wind and the Lion. He celebrates both Theodore Roosevelt and El Razule. So he's kind of like having it both ways. He's like acknowledging that there's like some puppet masters behind the scenes of the Spanish-American War. But at the same time, he's like, this is heroism. He wants to have it both ways. And does it work? Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. It's entertaining as hell. So probably.
Well, they do some interesting things. Like they show, you know, Hearst and the rest. They kind of bully McKinley into the war.
Mm-hmm.
But then they also have this scene where they're talking to Tom Berenger's pre-president Teddy Roosevelt at one point saying, you've done everything you can to make this war happen.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's an interesting line because I'd never heard that before that he pushed for it so much, but maybe he did.
Well, I think Theodore Roosevelt at the time just wanted war with everybody. I mean, he did. I mean, I can't remember where I saw this, but many, many moons ago, I saw like a list of like all the countries that Theodore Roosevelt wanted to go to war with in the years prior to like him becoming president. And there was like Chile and all these other countries that were just like lined up, and like he was a warmonger, plain and simple.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Interesting dude. The way that he's portrayed all the time. We kind of like think of him this way too. He was like this, you know, manly hunter man,
mm-hmm.
even though he was basically blind.
Yeah.
But that's our thing. That's like, if you know, it's funny you brought up Putin a little bit ago, but you see, like, they did Russia tried to do a thing with him a while back where, you know, he's riding around the horse shirtless and all this stuff. I was this is very similar. Roosevelt had stuff where, oh, here's him, you know, riding horseback through a river in Yellowstone, and here's him at his camp in the woods and stuff like that. They really loved kind of pushing that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a young dude. He became, a senator or something in New York off of this war because people were like, wow, he's great. And then so McKinley, who is played as like near death by Brian Keith in this movie,
yeah.
which is sort of sad in real life if you know about him. Brian Keith.
Yeah.
But
he ended up grabbing up Roosevelt to be his VP,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, McKinley got shot. And then, like, I don't know, 2 years after this? 3 years?
3, yeah.
And suddenly Roosevelt, who'd risen in standing quite a bit from this war, was suddenly the president.
Mm-hmm.
The youngest president we've ever had. So,
oh.
Yeah, it's just like,
younger wow. than Biden, really?
Yeah, well, no, Biden knew him. You know?
Yeah. They went to school together.
Yeah, Biden was his teacher.
Yeah. Biden's in this movie. He's one of the Rough Riders.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to think about. You know, this is such a formative thing in American history, but nobody really talks about it. So I really appreciate that this movie exists. Well, I guess some people talk about it, but not enough.
Yeah.
This really is the beginning of, like, America, the imperial nation.
Yes. It was about this time. Well, the Spanish-American War is when the United States picked up the Philippines as a colony, and Guam as a colony, Puerto Rico as a colony, Cuba as a protectorate. Then after that, immediately picked up Wake Island and American Samoa and Hawaii, and they got involved in the Boxer Rebellion in China, helped put that down. So this is like the turn of the 20th century. That's when the United States is like flexing its military might and saying, we're on the global stage now. And it's referenced by Theodore Roosevelt in the opening scene of this movie. Well, one of the opening scenes where he's delivering like a speech to a military college, and he's like, it is now time for the United States to step out on the world stage as a great power. And this is what this movie's about. It's about the United States coming of age.
Yep.
A speech at the end of which nobody claps or cheers or yeah. anything.
They're stunned by it. It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very weird. That was just like a strange little additional bookend.
Yeah.
But the weirdest thing in this movie is the framing it with the Brad Johnson character in old person makeup, which is terrible.
Yes, completely but unnecessary.
Very weird in the ending. I was like, why is this in the movie? The actual ending where he has taken to building a little white picket fence and put two headstones mm-hmm. where he had buried the treasure earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Just out in the middle of nowhere. And he just has put two headstones out there. One of his commanding officer, and I'm like, why is he doing this? This is weird. And then he just starts saying all this shit to them. Oh, millionaire. And I'm like, what the fuck? You go look this stuff up. None of the shit he says is true.
Yeah,
he's just like, yeah, he's just saying stuff to headstones that weren't there. These guys were buried in Arlington, Virginia. I'm like, this is just weird. So this guy, after the war, just went nuts. Like had two headstones constructed and put them in the middle of nowhere so that he'd go visit them and talk to them. So weird. I don't understand the ending at all. Very off-putting for me.
I was moved by it.
It is weird.
It is weird. But he calls it the First World War, even though the second one hasn't happened yet.
And yeah, that's the other. Everything he says is weird.
Mm-hmm.
He was also dead in real life at this point.
Yeah, I think he died in like 1902 or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt's dead at this point too.
Yeah.
It's like 1920. And you're like, well, he's dead. Like, he's like, yeah, I saw him. He's not doing too well. I'm like, that's because he's dead.
Yeah. Yes, that is true.
Should have been like, he refused to talk to me. He's just like you two.
Yes.
Turn into a gravestone for some reason.
Yeah. In fact, I'm putting another headstone over here. I'm bringing it out next week.
I'm going to bury Theodore Roosevelt out in the middle of nowhere.
I was like, do you think that his wife, who had a whole scene, like a tearful goodbye, do you think she might have something to say about you burying her husband out there? Dude has family. He was a soldier. He's a high-ranking soldier. And they're like, no. So I think that the bodies aren't there. I think he just put two tombstones out there. He's just being weird.
He lost his mind.
He's like, yeah, I put tombstones right where I buried that treasure.
Because friendship is the real treasure here.
Yeah. Well, I think the real Spanish-American War were the friends we made along the way. Yeah, it's that ending was just so strange to me that I was like, why? But the rest of it, I guess they're just depending on you knowing nothing
mm-hmm.
about this.
So. But, you know, I knew nothing, so
oh, fair
at the
enough.
Time I was fine with it. But, yeah, it doesn't really fit the bookends. It would have been better without.
So you're not an American, but, like, what was, like, this big indulgence in American culture like for you? Because this is, like, so American, it's, like, not even funny. So what was it like for you watching Rough Riders?
Well, this is not even close to being the most extreme example of it.
Oh.
I mean, there's just typical B action movies from the 80s that are more indulgent than this one.
Okay.
I mean, look at Rocky IV. Rocky IV is probably the worst example.
That's true.
Or the best example.
Yeah. And it isn't really revisionist either, so it's sort of, I'm sort of fine with it.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets a lot of details wrong, but it's not saying that the US won, even though they didn't. It's not pulling a U-571 by making all the British Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I don't have any problem with it.
Yeah, I guess it's because it's basically true. It's very hard to hate on it. When we're bringing this stuff, it's really nitpicking. You know, like when Mr. Big, like, yeah, he's a big polo player, which is like Milius saying, I don't think horse racing is manly enough, so I'm changing his vocation. Because that guy was a horse racer. And a little dude, because he was a horse racer. But they got this guy that's like 6'4" playing playing him. Also, the main thing I'll say, and this goes back to the Sam Elliott thing, is that everybody is way too old for their roles.
Yeah.
Like, these people should be, like, entering their 20s instead of pushing 40, every one of them.
But that's what they always say. There are no good roles in Hollywood for young men.
Yeah, there's just none.
No.
I always think when if I made a war movie, I would cast teenagers to play the main characters, because that's the truest way you could do it.
Yeah.
I was like, you need to reinforce that they're kids.
Then war wouldn't be glorious.
No, but that would be my point.
Yeah.
And I would just have all of the people that are in the, like, the war rooms and stuff, I would have them be, like, ancient. They'd be, like, it'd be all Joe Biden's, just everywhere, making the decisions, and the people on the ground fighting, it would be kids.
Yeah.
Even describing that, it's like, okay, yeah, that's fucked up. And you're like, because that's what war is.
Yeah.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, have you read All on the Western Front or not?
In the end, some capitalist rich fuckers got to keep their money, and that's what all those kids were dying for. Happy ending.
Yeah, well, they could really do a number, man. You could easily do spiritual successors to this film about the U.S. sending troops in every time a factory was like, we're not cool kowtowing to you guys or whatever. There were so many of these little, I mean, I guess they call them banana republics for a reason, mm-hmm. over in South America, which the U.S. would just be like, no, we are making, we love that you're making, or you're stripping bananas and stuff for us. We don't want to pay you more. So your workers can't go on strike. So we're sending in the military to make sure that you guys stay operational.
Yeah.
And there were like these bloody battles with American troops fighting essentially foreign union workers.
Yeah, it was a time called the Banana Wars in Latin America.
Yeah.
Installing a Pinochet in Chile.
Yeah, all this stuff.
That was a little after the Banana Wars, but yeah, that was another kind of like less than glamorous.
But related.
Yeah.
Also very much the CAA.
But, you know, related for sure. Again, this movie does a little nod with that fantastic shot of Roosevelt in the foreground and the American flag flapping, barely covering the sugar company, which is very hilariously named Empire.
In English.
Yep.
Yeah.
In English. Fantastic. I was like, good job. I was like, is this is subversive on purpose? Or
if it had been in Spanish, it might have been too subtle.
Yeah. They just didn't get it. They didn't get the joke. No. But yeah, once they get up to go back, once they get up to the ending there, the action editing and they really make it work. It actually is pretty thrilling and really cool to watch all the stuff. And he's doing a lot of different interesting camera techniques. There's one point where it does become handheld and it's just running up with the soldiers handheld, like on the ground going up this hill.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, shit. This is where Milius is coming alive. He's like, yeah, this is what I wanted the whole time. I wanted to show this battle scene. It's going to be awesome.
It's also it's like an hour long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking amazing.
Yeah, like half the movie is combat, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all the better for it, honestly. You know, during the whole early scene when they first show up and they're just wandering through the brush and occasionally shooting guys out of trees, I was like, I don't know about the action in this movie, man. But yeah, I didn't know they were going to wallop me at the end there. Hard-boiled-esque, like, huge, long battle scene. But I should have known because it was similar to Gettysburg in that effect.
Yeah, and it's John Milius.
Yeah, well, and it's Milius, too. Just the things people are saying is like, okay, that's very Milius.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the guy behind the Gatling gun just going, now I know what you're thinking. Did I fire 1,000 shots? Rolling 999.
Oh, man, I'm surprised that wasn't in the film. It's a deleted scene. The only deleted scene.
That one guy that was on the main, and he's talking about all the sharks that started eating them. Then we would have been like, yes, this is definitely Milius.
Yeah. But I think he's one of the great action directors of all time. Like, whether it be Dillinger or The Wind and the Lion or Conan the Barbarian or, of course, Rough Riders. I think his action scenes are just about as good as you could ask for from a movie.
Yeah. Well, he does like a thing where it's like, I guess technically accurate. Even Conan, which to me, that's like my favorite movie of all time. So they eschew the usual like fencing style sword fights to people just chopping each other apart. huge ass swords. I was like, all right, that's awesome. And this movie is like, okay, people are just getting shot, and they're getting shot in like weird places. So it's like every time you're like, ugh.
Yeah, it's like, as I said earlier, John Milius wants to have his cake and eat it. He wants to show like the glory of war, but at the same time, there's people being shot and like dying painfully from like gut shots. There's like one soldier after the Battle of Las Guasimas who's just like laying there, and they're like covering up his wound on his belly, and he's like writhing in agony and stuff. And it's just John Milius. He wants to have it both ways.
Well, he always says, or if you find interviews with him, he'll talk about how he missed out on going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
He just is like nostalgic for war that he didn't get to experience. Interesting attitude to have.
Yeah, it's like the most unpleasant war in American history. Why would you miss that one?
Yeah. Well, I think that he likes the idea of dying in war more than he probably would have liked to die in war.
Yeah. Fortunately, he didn't, and he made some great movies.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites as well. I love his hand on any movie. You're like, oh, cool, he's involved. Probably going to have some killer dialogue.
Makes everything so heightened and macho. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. I'm surprised that there were as many women characters as there were in this movie.
They're mainly just hookers and Theodore Roosevelt's wife.
And Sam Elliott's wife,
who oh, yeah.
I think says nothing.
Yeah, she didn't say anything.
And the French woman.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Man, there's so many.
The French woman. Mademoiselle Adler.
That scene was so weird. Mm-hmm. Where he's just walking, he's just dragging his wife around, being like, let's harass this diplomatic couple. He's like, I'm going to speak French, and then sort of speak German later.
Yeah.
And then we're going to just kill that guy.
Yeah. Which
is so funny.
It's so brutal. I mean, they just execute that German advisor with a knife. It's just, it's like, over before it begins. It's interesting because they call the Germans a Hun, which is not a nickname the Germans had picked up yet. That'd be 2 years later during the Boxer Rebellion when they were called Huns, but whatever. It's a minor historical accuracy. It's still a great movie.
Not enough movies about the Boxer Rebellion, by the way.
Oh, yeah. That's a very fascinating event. They have 55 Days at Peking with Charlton Heston, which is a good movie, but that's just about it.
Yeah, actually, I covered that one in one of my 60s series. That one's good.
Oh, yeah.
That one's another one where you're like, the battle scenes are pretty intense.
Yes, very. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to Rough Riders. This is the movie that made me love movies, pretty much. Prior to this, I loved Star Wars. I loved everything Star Wars, always did. And I loved Indiana Jones, too. That was the rediscovery of Indiana Jones and the discovery of Rough Riders are what really turned me into a film addict. Because I was one day, I was at Mr. Movies, which is just like the local movie store. I was like, I want to rent a video game. But then Rough Riders caught my eye, the old VHS copy. And I thought, they really don't make too many things about the Spanish-American War, do they? Not that I was an expert by any means. So I rented it on a total lark. I loved the hell out of it. I wanted it to end right away so no more characters would die. And I never wanted it to end at all because it was so entertaining. It was like this weird paradoxical feeling of like, don't end, but end right away so nobody else dies. And I just loved the hell out of it. And like, it made me love movies.
Mm. How old were you then?
Like 14.
Oh.
The right age for like a Milius movie, pretty much.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what it was, me and Conan. It was Milius. I think I was probably like 13, 14. And I was like, this movie's amazing.
Yeah, he's a very adolescent filmmaker, but that's part of the appeal.
Yeah, he's very, you know, like the Frazetta images of Conan. It's like, this is perfect for a young teen because it's amazing looking. And then you watch it and you're like, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. It's a shame. Yeah,
I think... What's up?
I was just going to say, this is a shame because this is Milius' last directorial effort, which just disappoints me. But I mean, he went out on a high note, but I don't know. He should have directed more.
And Brian Keith's last movie as well.
Mm-hmm. This movie is dedicated to him.
Poor dude.
Yeah.
They say, like, there's a lot of confusion on whether or not he killed himself or was cleaning his gun and it went off in his face.
Wow. It's like Melvin Purvis in The End of Dillinger, which is another Milius film.
Yeah, too many connections.
Yeah, it's all connected. We have the conspiracy board up here. You can't see it now, but it's in the background with like Milius connected to Dillinger, connected to Melvin Purvis, connected to Brian Keith. It's all
red yarn.
Yeah, red yarn connecting them all.
It should also be noted that Brian Keith was also probably dying of cancer very much when he accidentally shot himself in the face.
Yeah, well, that's the given reason for why he would have done it. But I know people close to him were like, he wasn't suicidal. But who knows? You know, you never know what's in somebody's head until the bullet's there.
Nothing anymore now.
Yeah. Some dark humor for our listeners. But yeah, it's I think it's pretty dang good, especially for what is essentially a high-budgeted TV war movie.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I really liked it. It was a bit of a tonal whiplash when Hamilton Fish, played by Holt McKellany, I don't know exactly how you pronounce it, the guy from all the David Fincher movies, mm-hmm. when he died, that's the first moment the movie gets really serious.
Yeah. But
once you get into the new groove that the movie has then settled into, it's great again.
Yeah.
Because up until that point, it's like you said, it's Teddy Roosevelt being a bit goofy, harassing people at parties, and all of a sudden people are dying.
Yeah.
It's a bit jarring, but again, if you just go with the movie, I really liked it.
Yeah, I think that they're doing a kind of, you know, there's a precedent for this kind of thing, you know, in war movies where you have characters that are sort of goofballs or whatever, and then they're forced to become warriors. They're forced to, like, completely change. It is very much coming of age, you know, for America thematically, but for the characters literally. The thing that aesthetically will stop you from getting that right away is that they're all much older than they should be. When you push that aside, you can see it. It's pretty clear. You're like, oh, these are all characters that are, this is a formative moment in their life, and it's a bonding moment. They all kind of get each other by the end. They're like, oh, I get you, I understand you. So several of the characters that are sort of at odds for a while learn to appreciate the other guy, and this constantly happens in the movie. The only time that it's like cut short is like the Sam Elliott Brad Johnson relationship, which I think at the very end, the closer you get is he hands him his gun, and then the last word out of his mouth is dash, because I think they're gonna be like, let's do this or something, but he gets shot before he can say it. And to me, that was like the big moment of the movie. I was like, oh man, when they kill Sam Elliott, don't even let him have a last word.
Yeah, the film is kind of egalitarian in outlook, which is kind of surprising because this was not an egalitarian time for the United States or anybody really. But like, there's a scene where like some like drill sergeant is like getting pissed at like the rich kid and saying, you're going to clean out the horse crap. And then Samuel comes up and says, get out of here. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like has this like egalitarian outlook on life where like everybody should be treated equally regardless of race or if yeah. you're an aristocrat or not. And of course, that may not be the most historically accurate thing, considering this was a very racist time in the United States. I mean, this was like the era known as the nadir of race relations in the United States. But in this film, it kind of has this kind of like outlook where everybody can be proved equal in times of war, and it makes everyone equal and all that kind of stuff, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, even like if you look up the actual battle, there's contention on who made it to the top of the hill first. Because it's very likely that it was a Buffalo Soldier, and people really did not want to give a black man credit for getting up there.
Mm, yeah.
And so it's just like, it's a whole thing. There's a whole bunch of shit about that. But the movie's trying to like capture that idea of everybody coming together, which is, again, this is sort of historically correct according to Pershing himself.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, I'm going to let it go. I'm going to let that slide because that's also supposed to be, ideally, what our country is about.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
You know, we often call ourselves the melting pot. Like, all of this, all of them can come together for a common cause, which is America. Whether or not we ever reach that ideal is a whole other matter, but that is the idea.
Yes, the shining city upon a hill or whatever it's called. Yeah.
And I think the movie approaches that with a certain amount of respect, and I like that.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, sure, America's not perfect, but, like, when you watch this movie, you get pumped up for, like, patriotism. You're like, yeah, let's go kill some Spanish people for no reason. Well, not no reason, but, I mean, they were very brutal to the Cubans, but still, it was a war started by a misunderstanding.
Not as brutal as the press would have had people believe.
Well,
as part of the reason we went was they were, like, they were literally saying, they've got people in concentration camps and stuff.
Well, they did have concentration camps in Cuba during this time, but not death camps like the Nazis had.
Yeah.
Well, they were in Guantanamo Bay, so it makes sense.
Yes, literally.
Yeah.
Nope, for it to get truly horrible, we actually had to take over.
Yeah.
Yeah, the interesting part about the Spanish-American War is we may have had the moral high ground when the war was actually taking place, but then as soon as the war ended, the Philippines was taken over by the United States. And they were like, we don't want to be a colony. And they revolted. And then it turns out like the exact same number of Filipinos died fighting the United States as Cubans died fighting the Spanish in their war. So it was like, what was this war fought over? You know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But they had sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'll be covered in the sequel.
Yeah. There is a good movie about the Philippine-American War, though, called Amigo, directed by John Sayles. It's a good one.
Oh.
I'm a back to baton guy.
Oh, okay. That is a good movie, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Show us as the good guys again, damn it.
Well, when you're fighting Imperial Japan, it's kind of hard not to be a good guy.
Yeah. But yeah, very good. Highly recommend.
Yes, I love this movie.
Especially if you're into the whole historical war thing. I think you can just watch this as an action movie too, but it is pretty long. I know some people are not about that whole long movie life, but yeah. I don't mind.
Yeah. It's pretty fast paced.
Yeah. And I watched it on YouTube. Ooh. So if you want to check it out, it's up there, ad free.
Cool.
What do you got to lose?
Yeah.
Right on.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's my favorite non-franchise film of all time. I know that's a bold claim, but other than Indiana Jones and Star Wars, you know, Rough Riders, that's my favorite non-franchise film. I just love this movie. It really got me into movies to begin with.
I can see why.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot as well.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Go see it.
Yeah. Go see it in theaters. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. Very good. Go check it out for sure. Enjoy the carnage and get swept up in the jingoism.
Mm-hmm.
That's my endorsement.
That's fair.
Yeah, you nominated this for the top 250.
Yes, I did.
And I can see it making the final list.
I hope it does.
Yeah, it actually is pretty well constructed action by the end. The final big battle scene is very well done. You understand exactly what's going on. And it's pretty intense. But also, even if it didn't have the construction right, it batters you so much with the quantity of action that I would have probably nominated it as well.
Oh, that's good to hear.
If I thought to do it. Mm-hmm. So
That's nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I agree.
Yeah. Good.
All right. Do you have anything else you wanted to add about this one?
No. I did look up something which is not really related, but it just struck me as really surprising. And that's that this movie takes place in the same year that H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds came out.
Oh, really? 1898?
Yeah, as a hardcover full book. It was published in the newspaper before then, but yeah.
I want to see a crossover now. I want to see, like, the aliens.
And with Dracula.
With Dracula, yeah. I want to see
a crossover. Let's tie all this together now.
That could be good.
Yeah, so that's kind of an unrelated trivial thing, but it really surprised me.
Yeah.
That while all this was going on and this was how people fought war, somebody wrote War of the Worlds.
Yeah, that's something else because I think I read that book in high school and, you know, it's obviously science fiction, so it's far out there, but this was going on at the same time. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know that it ties in with the technological aspect of the war. That's what that movie is, or that story, where like there nothing we have is in anywhere comparable to their technology. So they're just swiping our tank, our gun artillery away, and you know, vaporizing machine gun nests. And it's like no, we have nothing that can even touch them. And that's sort of what this war was, where despite what the movie says, the Spanish were vastly outnumbered by Americans and way out of their depth in terms of the technology used.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think the Spanish actually had the Maxim machine guns that are shown using in the film. I don't know if it's ever been confirmed. I don't want to say it's confirmed that they didn't have them, but I don't think any reports of the battle say, oh, they had Maxim machine guns.
Yeah, everything I remember about, in particular, the Battle of San Juan Hill, is that Lieutenant Parker is like, no, we'll use machine guns for suppressing fire.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to be fleeing and ducking, and we'll be able to charge right at them, because they'll have to, like, just lay on flat on their bellies, otherwise they're going to get hit.
Yeah.
And it kind of allowed Americans to steamroll them, even though this was a high casualty battle for Americans.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they often say, like, not to like tooth and nail, but they're like, they fought down to like the Spanish typically had like a dagger or something, and they'd run out of bullets and then resort to fighting with knives.
Mm.
Oh.
They really put one up on us, but didn't matter.
Yeah.
We had so many troops and we were just like so gung-ho for this and so much better guns. It didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
There are no smokeless bullets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because they bring up the Aztecs earlier. He brings up Hernan Cortez, Samuel A. does to them. And it's like, that's how they beat the Aztecs, was technology and numbers.
Well, not so much numbers, but yeah, you're right.
Well, they grabbed a whole bunch of local tribes and conscripted them to be soldiers against the Aztecs. And those tribes had grievances against them anyways. That's how they were able to get them.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense.
They didn't so much use guns, but as the movie states, swords. And there's really nothing they had anywhere near. They had, you know, wooden and stone weapons. And nothing against Spanish steel.
Mm-hmm.
And this was very similar, but it was like, now the shoe's on the other foot. Whole other country come and crush your ass.
Yeah.
With their superior technology numbers.
Yep.
But yeah, good times. I can't believe this is a 90s movie, but pretty fun.
Oh, yeah. Very few things like it.
Yeah.
I mean, it isn't really related to Gettysburg in any way, but it is the movie that comes to mind.
Yeah.
When thinking about Rough Riders as well.
Yeah, they're both kind of like those 90s historical epic passion projects with like lots of extras and practical effects and stuff like that.
And they're both really fucking long.
Yeah, that too. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What should people do?
They should join the Discord. Come on over here. Talk movies with us. Talk about how we're a bunch of imperialist pigs because we support this movie. And yeah, just come on in to our Discord. And if you decide that these conversations and our conversations that we may or may not have with you about being imperialist pigs are to your liking, then feel free to donate to our Patreon, All Out of Bubblegum. But any other way, please visit the website, alloutofbubblegum.com.
Well said.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Getting too old for this.